Okay, so I'm going to defend and develop a traditional view about sound, the wave theory. And now the wave theory has come on hard times, I think largely for bad reasons, and hopefully you'll have a sense of why I think that at the end of today. Now, this traditional view, the wave theory, dates back at least to Plato and Aristotle, both of whom claimed that sound was motion in a medium. And here, immediately, an important qualification needs to be made. Please bear in mind that motion kinesis is Aristotle's favorite term for not locomotion, but change of any kind. And so there's a kind of ambiguity in describing sound as motion and as a medium. On the one hand, you might think of the propagation of a sound wave, right, in terms of locomotion, like a body changing its place over time. But if we bear in mind this more general usage of the term motion to be change of any kind, it could be some other form of change, right? And in particular, I'm going to go on to suggest that it's probably better understood as a kind of dynamic information, right? And here's the kind of thing that I mean. So instead of the waveform changing its location over time, I think the waveform is successively instantiated by different things that have different locations at different times, and in particular, you know, different parts of the dense and elastic medium are going to be instantiating the waveform, and hence it's more like alteration. But we'll come to that. But at the very first, what I want to do is just lay down some assumptions that I'm going to be making. I'll maybe say a little bit to try to motivate them, but these are assumptions, right? I'm really not going to give a full dress defense of them. If you've got problems with some of my assumptions, you can always ask me about it later. Okay, so in defending and developing the wave theory, I want to make at least five assumptions. All right. Now, the first assumption I want to make is that I'm just going to assume that sounds are particulars. Okay. Now, assuming that doesn't impose a huge constraint on the metaphysics of sound, right? Because particulars can belong to different ontological categories, right? Ordinary material substances, of course, are particulars. But so are events, at least if we're thinking them the way Davidson does. So are property instances, right? So in maintaining that sounds are particulars, I haven't thereby rejected yet a Lockean metaphysics of sound that treats sounds as qualities, right? You could always think of sounds as particulars as being quality instances. But anyway, I'm going to assume that sounds are particulars. The next assumption, along with the first, is inconsistent with the Lockean metaphysics of sound. Right? In particular, I'm going to assume that sounds are the bearers or substratum of audible qualities. I think it's natural to think of sounds which have duration varying their audible qualities over their temporal interval, right? So a sound may begin loud and end softly, right? It might begin high-pitched and end in a low-pitched and so on. And yet, right, it's the same sound, okay? This could only be so, right, if sounds are the bearers or substratum of audible qualities. Now, this too is a traditional view. Aristotle subscribes to it in De Anima. It's got contemporary defenders. Casey O'Callaghan is somebody who thinks that sounds are both particulars and the bearers of substratum of or substrata of audible qualities. And I'm just going to be, again, just assuming that. Now, further, sounds are not the sole bearers or substrata of audible qualities. In propitious circumstances, I believe that we can hear as well their source. By source, I mean a sound-generating event, right? Sometimes our source talk can be associated with bodies. Sometimes source talk can be associated with events. I think if we mean by sources the kinds of things that we hear, right, there, it's the sound-generating event. And so what do I mean when I say we hear sources? Well, I'm claiming that not only can you hear the door, the sound of the door slamming, but you also, at the same time, hear the door slam, right? So I agree with Heidegger, right, when he says, look, you can hear the three-motor plane, the Volkswagen, an immediate distinction from the Mercedes, and the wind whistling in the chimney. Notice all those things are events, right? Moreover, they're events that generate sounds, right? And hence our sources. But, so I'm assuming that not only we hear sounds, but we also hear their sources. Again, understood as sound generating events. Another thing I'm going to be assuming, this time with Barclay, that if sources are audible, then they have audible qualities. Now, Barclay denies that sound-generating events have audible qualities, right, and thus claims they're inaudible. I think they're audible, and hence think they have audible qualities, but we both accept that conditional. What might be a candidate audible quality of sources as opposed to sounds? Well, I'll suggest, without really in the end giving a full dress defense of this, that timbre is at least a good candidate. And I think part of timbre's reputation for being a psychoacoustical dustbin is because people have a hard time seeing it as a quality of sound, but once we recognize how timbre is connected with material properties of the source, right, I think in the end it's going to be more plausibly thought of as an audible quality of sources of sound rather than sounds. But the important point is, here's something at least Barclay and I agree on, namely, you know, if sources of sound are genuinely audible, then they've got audible qualities. And the final assumption that I'm going to make is that the bearers of audible qualities, right, be they sounds or their sources, are events, right? So here I'm moving beyond merely the assumption that they're particulars, right? They belong to this particular ontological category, they're events. And to think of the bearers of audible qualities as events is really to think of audible qualities as qualities that are essentially sustained by activity. So it's like Ryle's example of keeping the enemy at bay, right? That's a state, but it requires activity to sustain, right? Or it's like the connection between heat and molecular motion. Heat's a quality, right? But it's sustained by this activity, this molecular motion. Okay, so those are the assumptions that I'm going to be working with. I began by saying I'm going to be defending and developing this traditional view of sound, why am I making all these assumptions about sources, right? Can't I just sort of, you know, crack on with it or at least just remain silent about sources? Well, here I think no, right? And here I think that an exclusive focus on hearing sounds can lead to a distorted conception not only of audition, right, but of the sounds themselves, okay? So with respect to audition, let me just say something quick and controversial. If you exclusively focus on hearing sounds, right, then this can tempt you to think that the function of audition is the presentation of sounds. However, you know, why exactly should we be sensitive to what are in effect local perturbations in the dense and elastic medium? That's a relatively uninteresting feature of the natural environment. Much more interesting are the distal events that such local perturbations are carrying information about, such as the approach of a predator or prey. So I think it's much more plausible to think that the function of audition is not so that we can hear sounds, but rather so that we can become aware of their sources. And again, if you just focus exclusively on the case of hearing sounds, right, you might be tempted to get that wrong. So that's one example how this exclusive focus on hearing sounds might distort our conception of audition. It can also distort our conception of sounds. With respect to sound, in effect, it can potentially lead us to conflating features of heard sources with features of sounds themselves. And in fact, I think that's a danger that a lot of the currently popular distal conceptions of sound, for example, as developed by Casale and Dokic, or Pasnow, or O'Callaghan, fall into. And I'll give you some reason for thinking that as we go along. All right, anyway, so that's why in these list of assumptions, I'm making assumptions about the audibility of sources as well as sounds, because in order to avoid this sort of what I claim is a distorting effect by an exclusive focus on the hearing of sounds. Okay, so sounds are particulars, and specifically sounds are a specific kind of particular. They're events. Well, what events might the sounds be? So let's begin by examining three candidates. First, you might think that sounds are events that would cause a pattern disturbance to propagate in every direction through a dense and elastic medium, should there be one. The pattern disturbance, of course, are longitudinal pressure waves that vary in amplitude and frequency. I'm just going to speak abstractly as a pattern disturbance. This first candidate is more or less how Casale and Dokic in their 1995 book are thinking of sounds. Well, instead of thinking of sounds as an event that would cause a pattern disturbance to propagate in every direction through a dense and elastic medium, should there be one, You might instead think of it as the causing of a pattern disturbance to propagate in every direction through a dense and elastic medium. And this latter view is something like Casey O'Callaghan's view of sound. Now, our third candidate is to think of sounds as an event of rarefaction, right? You know, after all, these longitudinal waves are compression waves, and to think of sounds as an event of rarefaction is to think that they're, well, propagation in every direction of a pattern disturbance through a dense and elastic medium. Notice I'm not identifying sounds with the pattern disturbance, right, but rather with their propagation in every direction through a dense and elastic medium. And what I'm going to do, first of all, is try to highlight some of the similarity and differences between these three accounts, right? The first thing I want to point out is a difference between the wave theory, right, where sounds are identified with the event of rarefaction, from the views associated with Cassati and Dokich on the one hand and O'Callaghan on the other. Namely, if you're thinking of sounds as an event of rarefaction, then it's got a certain kind of structure. If you make certain idealizations, right, you assume the medium's perfectly elastic, you ignore density, and abstract away from any obstructors, then you can sort of picture the event of rarefaction as an ever-growing sphere, okay? but neither of the other candidates have that structure, right? So suppose sounds are the events that would cause such a pattern disturbance to propagate through a dense elastic medium, should there be one. Well, to think of sounds that way is to think of them as the grinding, bowing, vibrating, resonating, you know, whatever kind of material event that is such as to cause a pattern disturbance to propagate through a medium, should there be one. And obviously, those things lack that structure that I described. Now, O'Callaghan sees a little bit more unity in sounds in considering the distinctive related event of the causing of the pattern disturbance to propagate through the dense and elastic medium. But even in that case, similarly, the event, the sonic event, as O'Callaghan is conceiving it, lacks the kind of structure that the wave theory attributes to sounds. Okay, so that's the way in which the first two candidates are perhaps more similar to one another, and the third candidate is different from them. Now I want to consider a way in which the second and third candidates are more similar to one another than the first. And the way to bring this out, I suppose, is to consider the tagline of the 1979 movie Aliens: In Space, No One Can Hear You Scream. These views offer different interpretations of that tagline. So let's consider the first candidate. Again, that sounds are to be identified with events that would cause a pattern disturbance to propagate in every direction in a dense and elastic medium, should there be one. Notice, right, that conception of sound is existentially independent of the medium, right? You might be an event such that you would cause a pattern disturbance to propagate should there be a suitable medium, even in the absence of a suitable medium, right? So sounds, as Kasady and Dokich are thinking of them, are existentially independent of a medium. And that means that sounds can exist in a vacuum. But the problem in that case is that in the absence of a medium, right, those sounds are no longer perceptually accessible, right? You need the medium to somehow convey information about this distal event, but there is no one. And so that's why in space no one can hear you scream. Not because there's no sound of your screaming, but rather there's no way for it to be perceptually accessible to anyone. Contrast first Kasady and Dokich's view with O'Callaghan's. O'Callaghan, remember, is thinking of sounds as the causing of the pattern disturbance to propagate through a dense and elastic medium in every direction, right? Look, you can only cause, right, a pattern disturbance to propagate through a medium if there is a medium, right? So in contrast to Kasady and Dokich, O'Callaghan's got an existentially dependent conception of sound. Sound existentially depends upon a medium, right? In which case, that forces a certain reading of the tagline, right? In space, no one can hear you scream. Well, because in space there is no medium, and if sounds are existentially dependent upon a medium, there are no sounds. Right? You may be trying to scream, but you're producing no sound, right? Because there's no medium for you to disturb. Similarly, the wave theory, obviously, if you're thinking of sound as motion in a medium, you're committed to sounds being existentially dependent upon that medium, and in this way, you'll give a similar verdict, a similar interpretation to the tagline as O'Callaghan. Okay, so that's some preliminary discussion of three candidate sonic events. Why favor the wave theory? Well, traditionally, there's been a phenomenological motivation for this. This has been criticized. I'll address some of the criticisms, but just sort of bear with me. Here's C.D. Broad describing the relevant bit of the phenomenology, and this is from Elementary Reflections on Sense Perception. He writes, "But the noise is not literally heard as the occurrence of a certain sound quality within a limited region remote from the percipient's body. It's certainly not heard as having any shape or size. It seems to be heard as coming to one from a certain direction, and it seems to be thought of as pervading with various degrees of intensity the whole of an indefinitely large region surrounding the center from which it emanates." Okay. Now, a couple points about this. Suppose audition has an emanative phenomenology. In this way, it's going to contrast with the phenomenology of vision, right? When you see a color, right, you seem to see an instance of that color quality, right, confined to a remote region, distant from the perceiver's body. Moreover, in no way do colors seem to be emanating from color objects, right? So you get this nice contrast between audition and vision. How does this connect up with the wave theory? Well, suppose that audition, first of all, does genuinely have an emanative phenomenology. We'll see Casey O'Callaghan try to make nonsense of that claim in a bit. But suppose, just for now, that it does have this emanative phenomenology. And furthermore, suppose our auditory experience with this emanative phenomenology is vertical, or can be, right? Well, not only is that going to encourage you to think of sounds as events, right? In particular, it's going to encourage you to think of them as the event of rarefaction. Now, Broad himself is not committed to the wave theory. This discussion occurs in the context of a comparative phenomenology of audition, vision, and touch. He draws our attention to some striking differences in our experience in these different sense modalities, only for these differences to be vitiated by the common causal mechanisms that underlie all our senses. So in the end, Broad's going to claim the emanative phenomenology of audition is illusory, right, and hence carries with it no commitment to sounds being the event of rarefaction as the wave theory conceives of them. So that's the primary motivation for the wave theory, right? The way it coheres with the alleged emanative phenomenology of audition. Now, I want to consider two kinds of objections to the wave theory, right? One seeks to undermine the phenomenological motivation of the wave theory that I've just sketched for you. And the other seeks to draw our attention to aspects of the phenomenology of auditory experience that are allegedly inconsistent with the wave theory. Okay, so here's O'Callaghan pressing the first kind of objection, trying to undermine, right, the phenomenological motivation for the wave theory. He says, it might be that sounds are heard to come from a particular place by being heard first to be at that place and then to be successively closer at intermediate locations. But this is not the case with ordinary hearing. Sounds are not heard to travel through the air as scientists have taught us to do. Now, the first thing to notice that O'Callaghan is understanding the propagation of a waveform through a medium on a certain model, right? He's specifically thinking of it as that waveform changing its place over time, right? He's thinking of it as locomotion, right? And here's where the initial distinction that I made right at the very beginning of the talk is kind of relevant, because I want to suggest that he's absolutely right that audition doesn't present us with sounds traveling from their source. But nor does the emanative phenomenology commit one to that. Instead, I think the propagation of the pattern disturbance is really better understood as a kind of dynamic information, right? With the pattern disturbance being successively informing different parts of the medium, where these different parts are themselves differently located. I forget which paper this is in. It's one of the two Bernie papers in the Nussbaum volume on De Anima, but anyway, at any rate, he's trying to lampoon Aristotle's claim that travel and a change in state are distinct by citing at length Pritchard, elaborating on just this point and echoing Aristotle's position. Unfortunately, I believe that at least in this instance, Bergitte was hoist by his own petard. And here's basically Pritchard's idea. Think of a wave in a liquid medium, okay? At one time, right, the liquid medium has a certain spatial configuration and the waveform is instanced in a certain part of it. At a later time, the liquid medium has a different spatial configuration. The waveform is now instanced by a different part of the medium. Pritchard claims that, look, strictly speaking, the only thing moving here are the oscillation of water particles, right? And the oscillation of these water particles has as an effect that this waveform is successively instantiated in different parts of the liquid medium. And that's the kind of thing that I'm describing as a kind of dynamic information, right? Now, so I think, like, O'Callaghan's objection is good against a certain model of propagation, sonic propagation. If it's modeled too closely on locomotion, then I think he's absolutely right. But that's not the only available model. And if you think of sonic propagation as a kind of dynamic information, then this objection doesn't even get going. Now, the second kind of objection doesn't so much seek to undermine the phenomenological motivation for the wave theory, but rather seeks to draw our attention to aspects of the phenomenology of auditory experience that are allegedly inconsistent with the wave theory. Here's Pasnow. He says, we don't hear sounds as being in the air. We hear them as being at the place where they are generated. Listening to birds outside your window, the students outside your door, the cars going down your street. In the vast majority of cases, you will perceive those sounds as being located at the place where they originate. At least you will hear those sounds as being located somewhere in the distance, in a certain general direction. But if sounds are in the air, as the standard view holds, then the cries of birds and students are all around you, and this is not how it seems. Now here, Pasnow's argument has really two parts. There's a claim about where the sounds are, or namely, if the wave theory is true, right? And there's a claim about our auditory experience, including distal elements. Bracket for the moment the first claim about where sounds are if the wave theory is true. Focus on the claim that auditory experiences include distal elements. So, look, when you listen to birds outside your window, or students outside your door, or the cars going down the street, what exactly are you listening to? Well, a flat-footed answer would be, well, birds, students, or cars, or at least their audible activities, right? And birds, students, or cars, or at least their activities, while audible, are not themselves sounds, but their sources, okay? So, in general, if you admit that we hear sounds and sources, then the mere fact that you can discover a distal element in our auditory experience isn't sufficient to establish that sounds themselves are distal, right? Because perhaps the distal element in your auditory experience isn't the sound, but rather their source. Okay, so, but what about the first aspect of his argument, the assumption about the location of sounds as conceived by the wave theorist? Well, I think of events like Davidson as spatial temporal particulars, so they've got locations, but it's impossible to think of the event of rarefaction, understand its location as being enclosed by stable boundaries, because it lacks stable boundaries, right? Davidson, complaining about the Lemon criteria, once remarked that, look, a flash or an explosion, we can happily assign a location, but we'd be baffled to describe its total area, right? So I think on some occasions, for some practical purposes, it's useful to give a perceiver-dependent location of sound. And on those occasions, we might say that sounds are where we hear them. On other occasions, for other practical purposes, a perceiver-independent location of sound is appropriate. And what's that location? Well, we can't describe that location as the being delimited by these stable boundaries, right? Because the event of rarefaction lacks stable boundaries, right? These boundaries are in constant indirect motion as the ever-expanding sphere grows. And given the neat symmetry of the event, right, we've got this pattern disturbance propagating in every direction, right? I think it's natural to locate such an event at its epicenter, at or near its source. Think about how we locate earthquakes, right? We do exactly that. So I think the location of sound, according to the wave theory, is an occasion-sensitive matter. Sometimes, for certain purposes, we can identify the location of sound as being where we hear them. Sometimes, for other purposes, it's natural to locate it at its epicenter, at or near its source. Okay, let me consider one other objection. And this is Callahan's argument from Tambor. He argues that certain auditory constancies concerning timbre favor thinking of sounds that we hear as the causing of a propagation of a pattern disturbance, as opposed to the propagation of the pattern disturbance, as the wave theory contends. So if timbre were an audible quality of sound, then this would favor thinking of sounds as the causing of the propagation of a pattern disturbance. And here, O'Callaghan is more or less moved by the connection between timbre and the material properties that are involved in the event. But here, I think that O'Callaghan's suggestion that timbre depends at least in part upon material properties of the bodies involved in generating the sound suggests instead that timbre's better understood as an audible quality of a sound-generating event, that is to say, of its source, rather than as a quality of a sound. And at least in the book where he's giving this argument, he has yet to consider hearing sources. And so I think he's misled here. Okay. So there's a pattern here, right? I've been suggesting certain views are conflating features of sound sources with features of sounds. Now, you might worry that in an intellectual context such as our own, where it's controversial what sounds are, how plausible is it for me to rely on the distinction between sounds and their sources? After all, if sounds are up for grabs, right, isn't the distinction up for grabs as well? Well, what ought not to be controversial is their sound-generating events. What may be controversial, whether sound-generating events are audible, it should be uncontroversial there are such events. Of course, which events they are depend upon what sounds are, since these events are the causes of sound. But it should be uncontroversial if there are sources. But even allowing, right, that the identification of a source, identification of an event as a cause of a sound, is going to depend upon the controversial issue of what sounds are, right, there's still things that we can all conclude about sources. For example, that they can be at a distance from the perceiver, that they have audible qualities if heard. And moreover, these conclusions about sources, if warranted, right, together with the claim that sources are audible, I think are may legitimately ground the lines of criticism that I've just sketched. Okay. Alright, so let me just kind of... How am I doing on time?
You've had about 40 minutes.
Yeah, good. So let me just sort of kind of dogmatically sum up the kind of view that I am attracted to. So according to wave theory, as I've developed it, the propagation of a pattern disturbance in every direction through a dense and elastic medium is the progressive instantiation of a waveform. So it's a kind of, not a case of locomotion, but it's a kind of dynamic information realized by the motions of the local parts of the medium, such as oscillation of particles. And though the sound event may be said to have location, the propagation of the pattern disturbance through a dense and elastic medium is not best modeled on locomotion. So it's not of a body like a sonic missile. As Callahan observes, right, that's just not how auditory experience presents itself. It's rather, as I've suggested, better thought of as a kind of dynamic information. So sounds are heard to come from their sources in the sense that the direction of the propagation of the pattern disturbance in the growth of the sound event is disclosed in auditory experience. So on that model, there are certain natural alternatives as to the location of the sound. The sound event, locating the sound event in the space encompassed by stable and determinate boundaries is impossible, since these are in constant indirect motion. Again, on certain occasions, for certain practical purposes, sounds are located where we hear them. On other occasions, for other practical purposes, sounds are located at their epicenter, at or near their source. And each alternative is consistent with sound being the propagation in every direction of a pattern disturbance through a dense and imperfectly elastic medium, understood as the progression of a waveform realized by the motion of the local parts of the medium. Now, as a dynamic information, the sound event has a kind of unity, right, that's irreducible to the motion of the local parts of the informed medium, right? Conceiving of the propagation of a sound, right, on the model of the locomotion of a body, a sonic missile, mistakes the unity of a sound for the unity of a body. Sound events may lack the unity of a body. After all, events and bodies have different modes of being. But the sound event, nevertheless, possesses sufficient unity to distinguish them from the informed medium upon which they existentially depend. It's a kind of dynamic unity. In particular, it's the force with which the pattern disturbance propagates in every direction and that explains the growth of the sound event. While the sound event may be realized by the motion of the local parts of the medium, the oscillation of certain particles, it's the force of its propagation communicated from one part to the next that determines the dynamic information. So the sound event is realized by the motion of the local parts of a medium without reducing to such motion because of its dynamic unity, the force with which it grows in the dense and imperfectly elastic medium. And it's the direction of this force that gets disclosed more or less clearly in the emanative phenomenology of auditory experience. And so in conceiving of the unity of sound, or at least its principle, as the force of dynamic information, sounds do not so much as travel as they grow. Thank you.